kind of guys who'd make you feel like that. Oh no!
Hello and welcome to Today in Digital Education, episode 118, with me, Doug Balshaw.
And me, Di Barnes. How you doing, Doug?
All right, my legs are a bit sore, Di.
Really? Well, that will happen if you go on an epic walk, won't it? So what have you been doing today?
True. So today is Monday, and I had this real longing to go and see the sea, but Hannah, my wife, was at work and needed the car. So I thought, I'm just going to walk. How far can it be? And I figured out using Google Maps that, and I usually walk faster than Google Maps, that I could drop Grace off at school, and then I could walk to Cresswell from Morpeth and back again in the time that it would take for her to be at school. And I did manage to do that, and I walked 30 kilometers and walked about 40,000 steps.
Wow, that's a long, that's a really good walk. Well done.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not a case of well done. It's more a case of like, I wasn't feeling that great mentally, and it really kind of blew some cobwebs away and did the job. So yeah.
I don't know. As we say in yoga, you know, you have to sort of acknowledge and appreciate the fact that you've turned up to the mat. You know what I mean? That you're there. Right. Yeah. And so, and I think that's the same sort of thing. If you make an effort to do something, you should be. It is well done.
Yeah, well, I tell you what, I don't know if you saw, I haven't put this on the show notes and stuff yet, but Craig Mod wrote this thing for Wired about walking in Japan. And I don't know if I mentioned on the podcast before, but I was talking to somebody, it might have been to you, Ty, about this guy, Craig Mod, and he did this six-week walk where he did 620 miles walking across Japan. So he's an American guy. And he's wrote this thing for Wired, and I think it's published today, actually. And it's called The Glorious Almost Disconnected Boredom of My Walk in Japan. And in this post, he talks about kind of how it's like this meditative experience. And, you know, stop me if I've already said this before, but instead of updating Twitter and Instagram and stuff on his way along, even though he takes lots of photos, he set up this system where he sent stuff to a server. And then the server sent out SMS and MMS messages to people like me who were following him. And you could reply. And he didn't see the replies. And the only way that he saw the replies was when he got back, he set up the server so that it automatically then published a book and sent him the book of the pictures, his updates, and all the replies automatically.
All right, okay. That sounds good.
So I guess I was slightly inspired by that, but it's an interesting read if you have a look at it.
No, it is interesting to get out and about and do some things. The photos look really interesting on this post, but sort of mundane, but just interesting things that you see as you fly by.
Well, he talks about, you know, what's he going to do as he walks across? And he decided to be the guy who says hello to everybody. And he says something about getting a 98% response in terms of the number of people who said hello back, which I thought was lovely.
I've been doing quite a bit of walking. I went on a long walk on Sunday, actually. Not yesterday, but a week ago. And I was on Camp Ed. So
explain what Camp Ed is for people.
So Camp Ed is essentially a group of teachers. And every year, for I think the last 7 years or 5 years or something, that they've got together and in a place up north in Yorkshire, and with their families and their partners, and they've gone and descended on this outdoor pursuits activity centre, and where there's camping available, and people can stay inside or outside or stay at a local B&B, depending on what your situation is and what you want. And they put together loads of activities for everybody to join in with, and some of the activities are organised by the children who attend, which is really, really cool. So I was fixed for the bank holiday weekend, and I work on a Saturday morning, so I couldn't go until Saturday evening. So I missed most of the sort of bespoke activities, but I did get to hang around for a fantastic thing called FemSoc, so Feminist Society, and this 16-year-old young woman had started a FemSoc at her school, she was sharing with us the best of FemSoc and different activities to do on Kahoot and things like that. that was really interesting. It was really brave of her to do it, and it was really fantastic, really interesting to see what the reaction had been like at her school and how brave she had had to be to like invite her peers and put something up, organize something of that sort among her peers. Mm-hmm. So that was really cool. Also made a sort of a jelly bone trumpet, which was like this trumpet made to look like a jellyfish with loads of fronds coming off of it, all made out of plastic and hose pipe, with mouthpieces in. And so we did that. It's going to be used in a parade somewhere. So
how many people would you say were there?
I would say 40 to 50 people, maybe something like that. People would come for just the day. They wouldn't stay over. And then some people were there for all 3 nights. So Elan, Ezekiel and his family were there, who is a good friend of Tide and both of us. And I know his family pretty well. So it was lovely to see them. But also catching up with Dougal McCormack, Dawn Halibone, Bill Lord, Alex Bellas, people like that, and who I've not really spent a lot of time with in a long time, Tony Parkin. Really cool. Really, really enjoyed it. And met some new people who I'd known on Twitter since 2008 but never met before. So
I'm meant to go every single year. But the thing is that it's always at a time when I have in-laws coming or whatever. So is that your first time there?
Yeah, so it's my first time. Elan's been once before a few years ago. And so I checked whether he was going to go, because it's always nice to have somebody that you know very well there. And so I thought, bugger it, I'm going to go. And I did. And I had a really good time. Lots of drunken chat, long walks and pubs. Went to where they filmed Last of the Summer Wine, which is UK TV sitcom show from back in the day. Yeah, it was really, really lovely, but just nice conversations, a lot of them about education, lots of them not about education, met some new people, caught up with old people, very good.
Excellent.
I really recommend going. It's quite raw and interesting, you know, it's quite, what's the word?
Unfiltered?
Yeah, it's pretty unfiltered. It's like warts and all, you know, because you're camping with all these people and it's, I stayed in the bunkhouse place, but yeah, you know, but it was really good fun, really lovely.
Excellent. Very good. Mm. Well, yeah, it's been half term for the rest of my family and not for me. And last week, I mean, I wrote about this in the week note. I put it in the show notes. But, you know, I don't know why I don't just book off every half term, because I find half terms particularly difficult when I'm, you know, when I've got I've got a non-teaching job, so I don't get like academic holidays and stuff. Because if it's Easter or the summer holidays or something, like the kids expect to entertain themselves and things. With a half term, it's like the same speed as normal school life in terms of everything's happening, whatever, but it's just different stuff. And yeah, I only worked a 3-day week last week, but for a combination of reasons, including product management week at Moodle, which meant I had to start work at 7 a.m. and all this kind of stuff. Last week was just really tough and I was very tired after it. The in-laws came up, which was great. But just, yeah, I think I need to take half terms off for some reason.
Well, that would make sense. I mean, the joy of being a teacher was, and with my children at my school, was all our holidays were the same. Mm. And to be honest, I found holidays really, really busy. It was like really hard work. I used to be quite pleased to get back to work in a way, but I used to really enjoy them because everyone would be at home together and it was really nice. And I can imagine having to work through the rest of the family having a holiday or being not at work is a very difficult thing.
Because you're not really away either. Like
especially working at home. Yeah.
Like I'm you know, just across the path in my little home office. But yeah, some good things. So two new team members have started, back-end developers for Moodle Net, which is good. Ivan, our designer and front-end developer, has come up with this new kind of much more conversational UX for Moodle Net, which should be good. And he's working on that. And what else? My son went to the Newcastle Eagles Academy. I don't think he's going to get picked because it was a year young. Went to this amazing, the Lang Art Gallery in Newcastle. Went to this amazing exhibition, and it's a very small one. The guy called Chris Killip, and he took photographs of kind of the decline of shipbuilding on the Tyne.
Oh yeah.
And because it's just one room, it's quite a small exhibition. I was in it by myself. I was there on a Friday, and just wandered around it by myself. And it was really kind of quite powerful storytelling going on just through these photos. And kind of, you know, if you get a chance to see it, it's really good.
Cool.
Yeah, so enjoy that. What else?
I read a book called
The People Versus Tech. I think this is one that I mentioned that I'd bought at the Thinking Digital conference, and I finished it by a guy called Jamie Bartlett. He's Jamie J. Bartlett with two T's on Twitter. Really interesting guy. No filler in this book, just all, you know, really to the point stuff. And he's talking about the impact of technology on democracy, basically.
I've just bought a copy. All killer, no filler. We'll have a bit of that.
Yeah. And I've given my copy to my brother-in-law because I think that the kind of people who are going to buy this book are people like you and me, Di, and maybe people who listen to this podcast. And actually, I think there's a lot more people who need to read it, and people who are, you know, like tech curious but not really working in tech. I think they need to see like, what's going on, because it was eye-opening to me, and I work in tech.
Cool. You put quite a lot of things in here for parenting. A Parent's Guide to Raising a Good Digital Citizen. I'm author Austin Kleon, and this is how I parent. And study finds research leads have little impact on pupil progress.
Yeah, let's talk about that third one first, actually. So this is something that Elan put into our Slack channel today. So this is on Schools Week. And this is reporting on the Education Endowment Foundation, the EEF. And my thesis supervisor was very involved with the EEF around those randomized controlled trials, RCTs.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it says 40 schools shared £270,000 to train a research lead and gave them time to implement evidence-based policies. So just in parentheses, the problem I have with evidence-based policies is what type of evidence are you looking for? And it's always grades going up. It's never really anything else. Anyway, it found that really didn't make very much difference whether the schools had these research leads. And so ironically, research showed that research didn't work. Anyway, Oliver Quinlan chimed in that actually the head of the EEF has now retired. It looks like the EEF has massively shot itself in the foot and probably won't exist this time next year. Who knows?
You're joking. Wow, there you go.
That's not what Oliver said, but that's the
long and short of it.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting whether you have, I mean,
yeah, sorry, go on.
I've just attended this evening before turning you on, I just attended a teach meet in our school, which as far as I'm aware is the first ever teach meet in our school. And I sort of helped set it up and generate some interest in it and whatever. And it was really good, and like 30 people rocked up, and dozen people presented. There's some really interesting stuff going on there, and I sort of thought about it as we were watching, and it's a really lovely thing because all the teach meets I've attended, which are I don't know, a dozen or so, maybe two dozen, I don't know, but they're with people that you don't know, that I don't work with, generally speaking, and in fact, completely speaking, and it's always, but it was a real pleasure to do it with people that I work with, because all these characters that you know on different levels, sort of as a colleague and friend and whatever, you never really get to see inside their classroom, or get to see them when they're saying, this is what I do in my classroom, and I think it's really good, and I kind of want to share it. And it was a real privilege, actually, to have that going on as part of part of what you do, you know. And so one guy was presenting.
Was it run as a traditional teach meet, or was it run as like the new style teach meets?
Well, I don't know what that means. I mean, it was traditional, as in we had beer and burgers and
you have like things being thrown at people who went over the time.
I was absolutely pelted by ping pong balls. So the guy who organized it, a gentleman called Oliver Peck, who's the head of science here, he opted for ping pong balls, and they worked really well because loads of people basically could do it. But obviously, for some presenters, people didn't want to throw ping pong balls even when they were over time, which is why we were throwing them, because obviously no one's talking about commercial products or anything. And so when I step up and I start doing what I do, no PowerPoint presentation, all of it live and demonstrating software and showing outcomes or whatever, that I just got absolutely pelted by these ping pong balls. And I said, look, at some point the ping pong balls are going to stop being funny, but they disagreed. So they just sort of kept coming. And then, yeah, that was quite funny. So
this is before you went over your time.
This is as I stood up, pretty much, sort of thing. I don't know, but it was really nice. So I always like to share something about how I'm feeling when I stand up in front of people. Do you know what I mean? So as I started talking about that rather than about the thing I was presenting on, they all got a little bit like, no. I don't know. It was so anyway. It was all done in good nature. Some people presented very seriously about great things, but it was just good to see what people are like invested in around the school. Some people were a little bit sort of showing off a little bit rather than showing something off. Do you know what I mean? It's a little bit difficult. It's a fine line, I think. But it was really, really good.
Showing that they knew how to do stuff.
Just showing the great work that they're doing in their department, but it was not sort of. Right. It was like some people. So you've seen me present. It's like I mean I'm very well rehearsed, but not necessarily very well prepared. So I know what I'm doing. And I know what I'm talking about. But it's I don't care if something goes a little bit wrong. I kind of deal with the mistakes as they come. I kind of almost because of my job, I want mistakes to happen in a way. I want to see people dealing with a mistake live and on the hoof, and it not taking away from what it is that I'm doing, right. and that sort of thing. So I don't necessarily, you know, like I presented, I need to put my computer on something. So I found a cardboard box that was like a pedestal height, just put it on top of that, rather than being all professional and showy, if you know what I mean. That's kind of my way of doing it. But other people are like reading from a script almost, like word for word, and everything is very, very, very well planned and very, very, very well thought through. A little bit too much sometimes. I think it loses a little bit of kind of fluidity, and they end up going through their script rather than emphasizing the things that they really feel are important.
Right.
That was cool. So we had some work on low stakes testing, on Kahoot, on collaborative PEE stuff in Google Docs. Really the Harkness discussion lesson style sort of thing, where the teacher just takes a back seat and monitors and assesses contributions from around the classroom, but the children are leading the work, which is done in a school in America somewhere. So that's lots of really sort of interesting things, but just a pleasure to... there was a nice thing on the Geography Forum where students will do individual research projects and present them. They used to do it to people in other schools, but now they just do it within Oundle, and it's nothing to do with the curriculum. It's just sort of individual interest pursuits and stuff that can go forward for Oxbridge applications and that sort of thing, just kind of upping the game a little bit. Yeah, cool. Some good stuff.
Good. So you'd recommend it still as a format?
I think for teachers getting up and sharing what you believe to be good about the work that you do has lots of value in that process, and for the people watching and share that they're sharing with, and for the people that are presenting as well, and the way that you reflect upon your work and develop yourself as a practitioner and a professional, you know, I think it's really good.
Good stuff. I'm just looking on the Teach Me website now. There's plenty going on. There's ones that are supported by like the College Development Network in Scotland and.
There's lots of space for it. I think, I mean, there's lots of space for that sort of thing. I've not really seen much in our world of Teach Me that we used to sort of get involved with, but
well, I think a lot of them might be like yours. They might just be instead small. Of it being like, oh, anyone can come along, which is feels like organizing an event. It might just be a lot more. Because you've got academy trusts and chains and stuff. They wouldn't necessarily put stuff on the general Teach Me website, I guess.
No, absolutely. I think that's right. I still had lots and lots. I think it's it's a really good working model. And even if people have like we always talked about, is a Teach Me still really a Teach Me? And I think a bet this year, they didn't have the bet Teach Me as it used to be. And it took on a different iteration this year. I couldn't go, unfortunately. I still think there's a lot of mileage in people getting together and discussing their work in a positive way.
And formats evolve and people need a bit of novelty every now and again, but there's something just as you say about professionals coming together to talk about their craft. And actually, Dylan William, writing in the Tez, see if I can find that quickly, he talks about the research kind of stuff, and he says that teaching is not a research-based profession, which I think is quite interesting.
It's an interesting conclusion, because he is a research-based fan, isn't he? But I think that whole research-based education thing is coming almost full circle these days.
Yeah, I mean, he talks about like teaching being an unusual job, and like I was talking to, I feel like I've talked about some of this stuff on, maybe I'm just getting deja vu, but I was talking to my wife about this. She's doing supply teaching at the moment, and I was saying, look, what other job would you be at a moment's notice expected to go to an environment where you've never met people before, no planning is left or anything like that, and you're expected to instantly like respond to the needs of the young people around you. Often you're the only person in the classroom and you're trusted to just get on with it and nothing bad happens. And at the end of it, kids learn stuff. Mm-hmm. That is not a science. That is very much an art.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. I'm just looking. I've gone through that article Dylan William has written, and there's a recommended article of 10 podcasts you should listen to change the way you teach. So if we just run through those 10, it's Cognitive Load Theory in Classroom Research, which is Dylan William. What Teachers Need to Know About the Teenage Brain, Sarah Jane Blankmore. What Should Assessment Look in Schools, Crazy Krista Dolu. What Every Teacher Needs to Know About Memory, Professors Robert and Elizabeth Bjork. Why Teachers Need to Create Routines for Learning by Doug Lamov, who wrote Teach Like a Champion. Why Growth Mindset is Not a Silver Bullet, guest Carol Dweck. What Every Teacher Needs to Know About Dyslexia, Professor Maggie Snowling from Oxford University. Three Golden Rules for Supporting Autistic Students by Dr. Luke Bearden, working in an autism center in Sheffield Hallam University. How much of your lesson should be teacher talk by Neil Mercer, a professor at Oracy, Cambridge, and a professor of education at the University of Cambridge. And What Every Teacher Needs to Know About Trauma, S.E. Viding, Professor of Developmental Psychopathology at UCL.
But this isn't Dylan William recommending these.
No. This is in the TES. That's what I'm saying. Linked to from the post that you just posted.
I was expecting to see Tide in there, but never mind.
Well, that's why I went through. I thought, I wonder if they put Tide in there. But they haven't. Their taste that is just clearly...
Well, they obviously don't appreciate the ramble chat. They obviously want the short, sharp, thematic episode with focused interstitial music.
Yeah. No, I think there's, and then this one thing you'll never worry about on Tide is the theme. The focus. What's the focus this week? Oh, flipping it.
There is one. There's definitely one. I think it's Osteopathy.
One.
Well, the thing is, I think it's interesting that because you'd expect Dylan William to come down the side of, research, etc. And he says, classrooms are just too complicated for research ever to tell teachers what to do. Teachers need to know about research to be sure so they can make smarter decisions about where to invest their time. But teachers and school leaders need to become critical consumers of research, using research evidence where it's available and relevant, but also recognizing there are many things teachers need to make decisions about where there is no research evidence, and also realizing that sometimes the research that is available may not be applicable in a particular context, end of quote. And so he talks about evidence-based education is missing the point. And it treats teachers as technicians rather than as, creative people. And I would say that, when you do research and you're doing research based on your particular context and you're going to the literature and then you're going into your classroom and then you're applying them vice versa, that is the powerful thing when you're making insights for yourself rather than just trying to apply, John Hattie's research from Australia.
Yeah. No, I think it's absolutely right. It's really, really complicated. And what I always sort of Ollie Peck, who is the head of science, did low stakes testing this evening and went into the research of it gently, but knows a lot about the research, done a lot of research. So I talked to him about the quality of multiple choice questions and whether they'd ever scrutinized that in great detail. And, you know, a multiple choice question is only as good as its wrong answers, as it were. And he wasn't really big on that. So do you know what I mean? And then if you start looking at the dynamics of how he teaches over time and looking at the efficacy of that and the impact of it, how do you judge it? What do you do to that? I was talking to somebody who's put in place a thing for digital strategy, and they're about to buy loads of kit to start for next academic year. And the head just intervened and said, I want 19 assessment targets stipulating what the success of this project looks like. And the assessment targets are all obviously in increasing children's grades. How is this going to, that's how we're going to measure.
19.
No, well, basically it was just, I don't know.
Well, going back to the multiple choice questions, MCQs, Oliver Quinlan was asking about this on Twitter, wasn't he?
I pointed him towards diagnostic questions that Miles Berry and other people have done towards computing at schools.
When I start working at Moodle, like, you realize how much people use MCQs. And some people use them amazingly well. I've been to Moodle Moots where people have like used them almost Socratically as a tool, like just
What you mean by Socratically.
So, you know, Socrates taught by asking questions. Mm-hmm. So you're basically teaching by asking people questions. And because when a really good MCQ, a hard one, you know, MCQs can be the hardest things to answer because you can structure them such that every answer looks plausible, not just because you don't know the answer, but because the way that they're phrased, there's different facets of things, or one is the perfect answer for a different question or whatever. Mm-hmm. So if you go to moodle.net/stats, across all of the registered Moodle instances in the world, and this is not by any means all of them, there are over 1.6 billion quiz questions, Di.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's because, I mean, this is the great... The great misnomer, I think, about tech is that tech brings scalability. It's like all this data that people are saying exists every day now is greater than existed in 100 years or whatever, like 10 minutes ago. Absolutely, this is technically correct, but it's meaningless because the data is just like rubbish. It's like every Google Doc that gets copied. And because a Google Doc gets copied, it means that somebody's actually using it for a purpose. And that's just not true. And it's a bit like this with, so if you can take a set of questions in a Moodle course, for example, and you can just churn them out again and again and again, they all appear as separate instances.
No, absolutely. No, you're right. You're right.
And that is a lot of questions. So you can't argue with the fact that there's a billion questions out there, but still it needs to be tempered with the truth somehow.
No, definitely, but that's 10 times as many quiz questions as there are resources, for example. So I just, you know, I have seen them used well, and I just thought it was interesting.
I think it is, and I think you can, so using multiple choice questions live in a classroom can be really fantastic, or using a Likert sliding scale sort of thing is really good because you can sort of get the temperature of the room and everyone contributes towards that temperature, and then you lift the lesson off that point, right? So we're there and we think this, so now let's go there, or let's look at the fact that we don't think this at all.
That's what makes great teaching, right? When you customize things, not only to the level of your pupils, you know, anyone can do that straight out of university. Like you go, oh, well, this is year 7, set 1, therefore they're going to get this. It's more to do with the personalities and, you know, whether they're knackered because they've just had PE, or whether they're really excited because it's windy or whatever it is. Like that's the art, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely, and it's responding to what's in front of you. I mean, that's why all of these things become, that's why the research stuff is, becomes so pointless, is because if you aren't able to respond, so there's a really interesting thing. So a friend of mine, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but he's now working at Wellington College where they have surfaces for every kid and every teacher has them, and they use OneNote classbook. And so I went and observed a couple of lessons there and talked to some people a week or two ago. And And it was fascinating to see, because when he was here, he just did not. He's a fantastic. He's a doctor, a young doctor of organic chemistry, and his knowledge really, really is impressive. You know, he's a very impressive chemist, and he wasn't necessarily the strongest of teachers. You know, his classroom management wasn't that great, etc. And he was very old school. It was like he'd use the odd PowerPoint, but mostly it was just him and worksheets and textbooks and getting pupils through the information. And now he's gone to Wellington and he's completely immersed and on, you know, he's marking all of his work electronically, and his lessons, all the kids are sitting in front of a screen while it, you know, there's no exercise books and paper anymore. And so I was asking him to write this up as a case, using him as a case study for like that transition to technology and into a sort of paperless classroom. Mm. And what his conclusions were very insightfully, one of the questions I asked him was, does this add value to the learning or to what takes place in your classroom? Does the technology add value? And he said, which I did not expect him to say, he said, if you're going to look at what adds value in a classroom, not his classroom, but any classroom, the thing you're going to talk about is never going to be the technology.
Right, say that again, sorry.
So if you're going to talk about, ask what adds value to learning, etc., in my classroom or any classroom, the thing that you are not going to talk about, your number one, two, and three, is not going to be the technology. It's going to be all about classroom management and dynamics and questioning and resources and planning and things like that. The tech is just the vehicle for it all. It's just not the big deal. I thought that was a fascinating thing.
Well, it is. It's quite a popular thing to say, like, oh, technology is just a tool. Maybe.
No, I don't think it was a popular thing to say. I just kind of think, you know, somebody who's genuinely excited, I said, would you take it away? Would you take the tech away? He said, absolutely not. He said, it saves me so much time. I don't have to carry things around. I know where everything is. All the marking and assessment that I do, the feedback I give to the pupils on their work in particular is recorded and stored somewhere in a structure that they can see and I can see. He finds it really valuable in that way. So a sort of thing. But when you talk about pedagogy in the classroom, that's not what is the most valuable thing by a long shot kind of thing.
Okay.
Which I thought was interesting.
No, it's interesting seeing especially young teachers going on that kind of journey. And I remember it was only for a very short amount of time, but when I was at the academy as director of e-learning, I was mentoring a master's student who'd come over from Australia. And he was pretty old school, and he wasn't there for, he was only for a number of weeks. But even in that amount of time, seeing the progress in terms of just confidence of like, oh, I don't need to be the person who knows everything about everything, especially when it comes to technology, because the kids do want to help me with this. And they aren't just going to take the piss, even though it wasn't a great school. But yeah, seeing the journey they've gone is really interesting. I want to move on to something which you just mentioned before, a parent's guide to raising a good digital citizen. And I don't think you've had a chance to read this beforehand. But I'm always interested when people post things like this, especially when they're parents themselves, because I think that it's easy to pontificate when you're not a parent and say, oh, well, this is what you should do. And even when I was younger, the number of things that I thought I would or would not be doing is completely different to now when I have a 12 and an 8-year-old boy and girl. So this particular one starts off well, talking about a parent's guide to raising a good digital citizen, and her kids are 7 and 5, and they get 10 minutes a day on the iPad, and it's supervised. She says, I supervise my kids while they use the internet. I only let them on for 10 minutes or less, while all the while pinging them with questions. I don't hand off the iPad and let them have it. Yes, I'm one of those. Call me a fuddy-duddy, call me a digital philistine, call me annoying, call me what you want. I won't sit with them forever, only until I'm convinced they have the skills to distinguish fact from fiction online, that they understand what they're looking at, and what or who is looking at them. Why? Because being a good digital citizen is critical in this hyper-connected world. The alternative isn't pretty, yada, yada, yada. And then she goes on, and this is the American woman writing on Engadget, at the end of the article it leads to an Engadget guide to parenting in the digital age. And I think a lot of this is well-intentioned, but I think a lot of it is completely unrealistic.
I can't read it.
She's pointing to tools that I use, like Common Sense Media, but it's as if, it's like going back to the research, the EEF research stuff, as if like, well, all of the stuff you need is over there, just read it, just implement it, and you'll be done. And of course, context is everything. And she kind of touches on that a little bit, but like, for example, Common Sense Media. With Common Sense Media, as I've actually blogged about a few weeks ago, you can't just go on Common Sense Media and say, oh, my kid's 12 years old, therefore what should they watch? You have to like look at what Common Sense Media says, what the parents say, what the kids say, what the reviews say, think about what your kid's seen previously, the context in which they're watching it, all that kind of stuff. And to be fair, Common Sense Media does provide lots of different data points for that.
Yeah, but, no, it is good.
Yeah, I just think it's...
I think it's interesting this. I read some interesting research this week from Oxford University. So it says the academics at Oxford University have found little evidence of a relationship between screen time and well-being in adolescents. Based on data from more than 17,000 teenagers, the study casts doubt on the widely accepted notion that spending time online, gaming, or watching TV, especially before bedtime, can damage young people's mental health. And what's really interesting here is that Oxford University are trying their best to actually develop this research into something more robust, as in their collection points or collection methodology or methods are more robust and things like that. And they're still not able to find any conclusive sort of evidence of what everybody is saying. It's sort of fascinating in a way.
Well, the thing about this is that, like, it tries to hinge on things like use analogies of like the offline world and books and things. There is no way I would sit all the time with my 7-year-old kid. You know, my daughter's 8. She doesn't want me to read bedtime stories to her anymore. I do, even though sometimes she doesn't want me to. She's devoured like 3 David Walliams books last weekend just because she loves reading, and she loves rereading stories as well. So I just like, off you go, just do stuff. And so whereas previously I was thinking I was going to be the kind of parent who'd be, you know, guiding them a bit like this parent here, guiding them and have no filters on and all this kind of stuff. Actually, what I've ended up with is here's your constraints and boundaries. You know, have at it for a period of time. I'll check on you every now and again and ask me questions if you come across stuff you don't understand.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough, and it's a difficult. All of it's difficult to fathom what you're going to do, and I think you know you're hitting that right at the moment because the age of your children is right on point for how much tech do I give them, how much time do I give them, and all of that. What in the time that you spend with your children, what do you spend time doing, and all of that. So I don't know. It's a tricky thing. But I'm interested in the screen time question because if I'm going to put screens in front of every pupil's eyes every lesson of the day, as well as all of the leisure and time that they spend with it, you know, I think that's a question: is it the right thing to do? To give, you know, should we not protect the classroom as somewhere that where screens are used only when they have to be because they are necessary, and that sort of thing? I don't think that's really as straightforward. I mean, in my life, I like to find new things that don't involve a screen often because I use the screen a lot. And these children that are in my care of sorts are going to have so much screen time in their lives. Is it more sensible to get them used to it and dealing with like good routines that involve having a lot of screen time every day, but also having breaks and rests and exercise and fresh air and all of that sort of thing? Or is it something that we just avoid them using because they're still children, they're still in development, so we do not subject them to the same situation they're going to be when they're adults? You know?
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it, trying to think about the world that, because we project back to the way, we've talked about this a million times before, about project, we think that the world, we compare it to the world that we grew up in, and the world's completely different. The social, I tell you what's been really interesting for me, the way that, you know, my son plays a lot of Fortnite, and Fortnite's really evolved. Like, you can play non-shooty games within Fortnite now. It's more like Minion Rush or something like that. But Fortnite, they're opening up to other developers. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting is that you can now play Fortnite without ever playing against other people that you don't know in like sandbox mode, making your own levels. You can create levels almost a bit like Minecraft, I guess. And then it produces a code so that you know, YouTubers or whatever can share codes, and then that world gets recreated for you. And then you can have competitions against your mates. So my son's playing mostly that all the time now.
See, I need to have a chat with Ben, because I'd really love to set that up in my school and to be in control of it so that we can have gaming competitions, but just within our own environments against each other and that sort of thing. But across the whole school, you know, so like inter-house competitions in Fortnite, I think would be awesome.
Well, Fortnite's free, so why don't you get it installed and one night, instead of playing me on Red Dead, you can play Ben on Fortnite.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. You could play too. Can two of you jump in from one machine or not?
Well, he actually goes under my username, because when he first went on, he'd set up his account to be him with his real birthday and stuff. And because he was... you have to be 12 to play the game. And at the time, he was 11. So he set everything up on my account. So he doesn't want to switch back to his account, because otherwise he'll lose all of his like progress and stuff.
I think that's a big deal. And I do know that because I get a Twitch notification when you start streaming. So it says streaming on Fortnite. And then I turn it on and he's turned the streaming off.
So really?
I don't get to see him play.
cheeky. Mm-hmm. The point I'm making about that is that parenting is not the easiest thing in the world, especially when you throw in devices. And another thing which I've linked to here is, and it looks like it's on a blog called Offspring, but it's actually Lifehacker dividing all their different blogs now, their different series, into different blogs. This was offspring.lifehacker.com. So it's a parenting blog. And Austin Kleon, for those who haven't come across him, he's got a new book called Keep Going, but he's best known for books like Show Your Work and Steal Like an Artist and things like that. So interesting guy. Highly recommend getting his newsletter and following his posts and stuff. In fact, this morning he does this blackout poetry where, you know, I'm sure you've seen it before, where you get like a newspaper and you black out lots of words and you create a poem from the words that are left. And he's particularly good at that. And my daughter and I were doing that before school this morning, actually. Anyway, he answers these standard questions that Lifehacker throw at him around, like, tell me about your family and career. What gear do you rely on? What about apps? Has having kids changed the way you work? All that kind of stuff. And about halfway down is a little cartoon that his son drew, which I've used for one of my blog posts. And in the first pane of this little cartoon that his son's drawn, it says, "You didn't look like you were working on a book." And the second pane says, "You looked like you were working on your computer." And this is the thing I think about all the time. The fact that my kids just see what I'm doing as undifferentiated work and not actually sometimes it's me writing for fun or whatever.
Yeah, they don't know that that's going on. They just see you as... I mean, I do think this. I remember growing up seeing my father as a bank manager, just forever banking. And I just thought he was a banker. do you know what I mean? But that's all he would ever do, really. And it's kind of... I don't know. You don't have... When you're growing up, you just have these broad brushstroke perceptions of things, and they're rarely accurate. My father's life would have been rich and full of various different things, but I never saw it as that. Different relationships, things that made him nervous, things that made that he was confident and comfortable in, and things that got him excited or whatever, and I would never see that. Do you know what I mean? I'd know if he was in a good mood or a bad mood, and I'd always know that he had work to do, because he always did.
No, exactly. And it's trying to narrate the story of adult life. That's why I really appreciate the fact, I find that when I drive my children somewhere, sometimes I get to have just relaxed conversations with them. But most of the time when you're in the car, you're like hurrying up, or the traffic's annoying or whatever. But when you walk places with them, you get to have these really interesting little conversations. Where they ask unexpected questions. And Grace asked something on the way to piano today. I forgot what it was. It was something to do with scale. Something about the fact I'd done these 40,000 steps, and she likened that to something else. And you end up having all these really interesting conversations. But back to this Life Hacker article with Austin Kleon. He's asked the question, what's your greatest parenting hack? And he says, it's not really a hack, but an ethos borrowed from John Holt. Trust children. We try really hard to have all of their materials out in an eye level and freely available, and we trust them to do their thing. So that means like leaving markers and paper out for the four-year-old and letting the six-year-old play in the music room with my recording equipment. We've had a few accidents. One time, Jules drew on our couch cushions with chalk, and Meg decided to embroider the drawings. And he's embedded the tweet below.
Yeah.
So this kid is drawn with like orange chalk on the cream sofa, and it's obviously not going to come out at 40 degrees. And so his wife embroidered over the top of it, and it looks awesome.
It does look cool. And I think there's lots of it's an interesting thing. You can often, like, the things that children do. I mean, there are times when children have want you to see that they're doing something deliberately badly. But most often that's not what's going on in their head. They're looking for something interesting to do, and often looking for something that will interest you as well, that will get your attention and hopefully bring you into their sphere, if you like. And and I think that's a good example of that. And hats off to Austin's wife for embroidering, not getting angry.
What's the name of that cartoon, the American cartoon with a little kid and a tiger?
Oh, I know the one you mean. I can't remember.
You know the one I mean?
Yeah.
So there's a particular one of that one I'll be able to find very quickly. But basically, he's hammering nails into the coffee table in his lounge. And the mother goes, "What are you doing?" And he just looks at her as if, like, are you cracking jokes?
Like, yeah.
I'm hammering nails into the coffee table. And
it's Calvin and Hobbes.
Calvin and Hobbes. Calvin and Hobbes cartoon. See if you can find it. Just the look he gives of, like, well, obviously I'm hammering like tacks and nails into the coffee table for fun. This is what I'm doing. I tell you what I really like in this article as well. He's got a photograph of his kid standing at a very brightly colored table. Previous artwork by the kid is clipped up on the wall. There's little boxes with all different materials. There's to his left, there's different colored paper just stacked. All the stuff that he needs to be creative is just there. And, yeah, our house is probably a little bit too small to be able to do that, although I'm sure we could do it on a smaller scale. Really nice anyway.
I found the things. Nails in the coffee table. It's very lovely. Cool.
Anyway, there's a whole series of these interviews. There's one by the author of a book about how to raise awesome daughters. There's one by women, by men, by all people you've heard of, people you haven't, and they're all just great. Oh, cool, you found it. There we are.
Yeah. The one thing I would tell other parents who are juggling a career, it's not you. You're probably doing the best you can. It's just that everything is stacked against you. Everything from a lack of affordable childcare, underfunded schools, crumbling infrastructure, bad health insurance, to a world that's just really and truly insane. It's near impossible, and it's not your fault. Just keep going. Do the best you can. Wise words.
Oh, the Calvin Hobbes cartoon. Whap, whap, whap. Calvin, what are you doing to the coffee table? He looks blankly. Is this some sort of trick question or what?
It's a beautiful thing.
Because I've had my kids look at me like that before when they're doing just gloriously naughty things. Just don't even realize. Anyway, let's move on to the tech section, shall we? So one thing I did want to make sure that I got in, because often these kinds of things get pushed down the order and we don't get to talk about them, is that today I was going back, there's something called mobilisation, which is a French word, because the organization Framasoft are based in France, and they do awesome open source stuff. They develop open source products and run open source services. So this thing, Mobilisation, which I have backed to the tune of 10 euros, is looking to raise about 50,000 euros, I think, to create an alternative to everyone putting their events on Facebook. And this is what they do. They try and make alternatives to stuff. So I was looking today at some of the other things that they do, these Framasoft apps. And the way that they phrase it, they frame it, is de-Googlifying the internet. But whether you agree with that particular approach or not, some of the tools they've got, I mean, they've got like a one, where is it? It's an alternative to Padlet, which is completely free and you can use for whatever you want to do. Where's it gone? It's an awkward name, Far Memo. And it allows you to things like Padlet. There's all different kinds of things like forms and being able to take an alternative to Google Maps and add your own collaborative features, the mind maps and slides and agendas. There's an alternative to Doodle, all different kinds of stuff. So I think if you're a teacher or any kind of person who's looking for a free alternative, and I mean free in terms of free the philosophy, but also free in terms of cost, I would definitely look at some of these tools.
Is this, which tool is this one? Which number? Or is it all one tool?
Sorry, which one? I'm looking at the link, which is called Framasoft Apps.
Yeah, I know. I've got Framasoft Apps. Is that at the top? I'm on Framasoft.
So I've linked directly to it, I think.
Oh, okay. So you've got the one with Build Your Own School in. That's the piece of software you're talking about. Is it one piece of software that does all of these things?
No, it's lots of different services. So on free services, when you go to the Framasoft website and it says free services, there's loads on the link. And if you click on Tout le service, then it shows you all of them. And it's under the title De-Googlify Internet. And it's got loads of them.
Oh, okay. Oh, I see. Yeah.
So some of them are just taking existing open source projects and putting their own kind of spin and wrapper on them or whatever. And it reminded me a little bit of something which I mentioned, a good couple of years ago, called Sandstorm. And Sandstorm's it's an open source platform for self-hosting web apps. That's what it calls itself. And we tried it when we were setting up our co-op, and it was a little bit too difficult to use. But I think that there's going to become a time when we do question in schools. Like a few years ago, Di, you and I probably both would have recommended that people had a mixed economy approach to using different tools and stuff in schools. Whereas now it's become almost impossible to do that, as far as I can gather. You know, if you try and run Google and Microsoft and everything else together, it just becomes problematic. And it will be nice to have alternatives to that, you know, if you don't want to get sucked into a particular silo.
Yeah, no, that's true. And it's, but saying that, I run everything alongside each other. I mean, that's one of the things that I'm trying to hold on to, is the idea, that you're not going to get into one big tech corp silo, a sort of thing. And it's really hard for other people to understand, but I think it's really, really important that we leave our users with choice, and that we show that we're going to have the big basic services in place, but on top of those, that platform, of which some things like email accounts, for example, you must use a certain Microsoft Exchange for email, and our MIS for reports or whatever. But you can actually use your productivity tools of choice and do what you want, and to use the different kind of tools in the classroom that you want to use, because you believe in them for whatever reason. I think that's important.
Well, yes. Well, I just thought I'd point out, because I thought people should be interested in these things. And it kind of links to something which I thought was a fantastic post by a guy called Nolan Lawson. Nolan used to be a web performance guy. I think I came across him because he lives in the same kind of world as Paul Lewis, who I know, who works on web performance on the Chrome team at Google. So Nolan Lawson worked on that for Microsoft, like making things really snappily render at Microsoft, and then he's now at Salesforce. And he went all in on the Fediverse on Mastodon a couple of years ago, when I was kind of scaling things back a bit from Twitter. he just deleted his Twitter account, and I think he had quite a few followers. Anyway, he is in this blog post. He talks about tech veganism, and he's using the parallel of veganism with people who say that, you know, you should use only open source software instead of proprietary software. You should be suspicious of big tech companies. You should have a really high bar in terms of when you're dealing with other people around privacy and security. Uh-huh. I think I was on the road to that probably last year. I was talking a lot about this kind of stuff, and you just end up getting really alienated. And he goes through the parallel with veganism, and he goes through several reasons for this. So first off, he says, you know, a lot of people find vegans annoying, like as if they're trying to come across as being better than you know, the person that they're talking to. Mm-hmm. Secondly, he says that people aren't tech vegans because it's a better user experience. They're doing it because they have principles. Yeah. But they do say, oh, well, you know, this black bean burger tastes just as good as your Angus steak burger or whatever. And that's not actually true. OpenStreetMap is not as good as Google Maps. DuckDuckGo is not as good as, you know, Google search. Thirdly, he talks about tech veganism being a good way to alienate people. You know, it's like someone's eating a burger and you're constantly telling them, oh, factory farms and processing and all this kind of stuff all the time. It's a bit like when people are talking about technology and you're always going on about privacy and security and all this kind of stuff. So it's costing you friends. Fourth, he says tech veganism can be difficult, if not impossible. Like the high bar in terms of knowing your tech skills is just crazy. It's almost impossible to avoid proprietary software or the tech giants. And also he talks about how it's really difficult because everything depends on context. So if you live in a world, like he gives the example of India, where there are more vegetarians in India than elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So it's easier to be vegetarian in India. It's a bit like if you lived in Brighton, it would be easier to be a vegan in Brighton than it would be where I live, for example. So he's basically calling out all these people who set such a high bar around privacy and security, who want everybody to use open source software instead of proprietary software. He's saying that it's like the worst type of vegans, basically.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really well-written post, and I have responded to it in a post which I'm going to put on Thought Shrapnel about how, using the same parallel, I'm pescatarian. I'd like to, you know, I don't think I could be vegan because I like cheese too much, but I do like the idea of being vegetarian. But it's a slow process. You don't get there by people telling you you're wrong all the time. You come through to it by your own personal realization.
Yes, I think it's it is a really good analogy, and it is the sort of thing. I mean, I do try to use open source kit where I can, but also I think I'm sooner to relinquish that principle than you are, and I think lots of different things about it. I think partly in my job, I need to know what's going on and what it feels like to be inside of social media applications and using them. Mm. Although there comes a point at which you kind of learned everything that you need to know, more or less. Although some people's behavior, I mean, rarely when I'm on these social media platforms, I stay within my own silo rather than going and discovering what else is out there. And when you actually go and look, it's quite appalling what's out there, the things that you can find on it. And everyone's sort of fear about them becomes much more contextualized and rational. And I think there's a lot of this going on, but there's also a little part of me that thinks that we're in this massive transition of the technology age or something. And that, where we are is nowhere near where we're going. And it's gonna, you know, there's a certain extent to which that technology has been used for bad purposes, to do with what he's identifying here with GAFAM, as he calls them, the all-American big five tech corps.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is the thing.
There are other good things going on as well.
It's supposed to be so liberating in terms of us personally, but what's actually happened is that it's provided a freeway for the commons to be enclosed by big companies who can take stuff and never give it back, like Amazon, for example, who don't contribute to open source software at all. They just take it and use it and close it.
Yeah, I bought a book actually called Upheaval. Have you heard of that?
No, is that fun?
It's by a guy called Jared Diamond. And it's How Nations Cope with Crisis and Change. And
so I've read his Guns, Germs, Steel.
Yeah. So he's an interesting sort of self-anointed geographer and historian. And so all I've really... I mean, I heard him being interviewed on Radio 4 and thought lots of things. But I thought, I think I quite like to read that and to sort of make a more detailed assessment on it and reflect on it more. And it's a little bit like that. And what he kind of said was that I'm right in this. I listen to so much crap. It's so hard to work out what came from where. But the idea that the only people that think that expanding our economies, the financial, you know, economic growth, the only people who think that is a good idea are economists and idiots, and that what we need to be doing is actually working towards sustainability in the world that we are in now, and what is happening under sort of consumerist capitalism that we, many of us, live within. Is that we are still just inflating economies to points that they cannot sustain. And it's just, you know, it's an unsustainable model. And we need to actually work towards sustainable goals of how we make the finite resources of the world work for the population of the world and look after the world, in which I think lots of people are coming around to. But he's just taking it on a more big picture.
It's a new book, isn't it? Because I just remembered that the one that I really enjoyed, so Guns, Germs, Steel was fine, but the one that I really enjoyed was Collapse, which is subtitled How Societies Choose to Fail or Survive. And that's his, I think that's the one he did before Upheaval, so 2011. And in Collapse, the thing that which really stuck with me was he talks about all of these islands, like these Polynesian islands or whatever, that have been very successful. And then they cut down all the trees on the island and then they can't survive and everyone dies. And he says, who was the person who chopped down the last tree on the island? Like, how much of an idiot were they? And then you realize, no, there were certain things which caused there to be some kind of competition or race, or the way that things were caused people to act in a certain way. Mm-hmm. And to me, that kind of fits into our whole situation and conversation about climate change, because I know that there's a climate crisis and I know like what we should be doing and stuff, but when you look, and we've talked about this before, it's the environment that we live in. Like, it's very difficult for me to do enough recycling or enough kind of stuff on my level to make any kind of impact. It's the huge industry, it's the economic incentives, it's all those kind of things which are, you know, screwing the earth.
Yeah, I think it's a difficult thing when you so I was watching some political stuff. I watched an interview between Alistair Campbell and Tony Blair from about a year and a half ago, I think, for GQ magazine. It's an hour long, and I think Tony Blair is one of the most impressive statesmen that I've ever known in any way, shape, or form, and as in reading about or whatever, listening to. And I think the way he talks about the political landscape of the world is really, really interesting. It's really insightful. He doesn't get drawn into personality politics at all. He's very careful to protect his influence and that he might have in the world by not being nasty about anyone in particular. And talk about the policies that are at play and why things are complicated and what we can do to actually make change about it. But then there's also, you know, he's taken $30 million off some dictator in the Eastern Bloc and to service his company, which employs 200 people, but those 200 people are looking, are doing amazing work in Africa and genuinely working towards a solution in the Middle East, which is evolving America. So he's not slagging off Trump or anybody else because he's wanting to maintain diplomatic relations with them, because they're at play. You know, he's trying to bring these people together to do something different. And Tony Blair has a lot to answer for through his premiership and what he did in Iraq. To my mind, and it doesn't sit easy with me, but still I look at people who are talking about the world, and thinking, who are the grown-ups here? Who are the ones that are really trying to find, something that's going to make a big difference, and he strikes me as being one of them, oddly, which I probably get shot down in flames for by many people, but you know, I do try and listen to people and give them their space to speak and make their points, and it's and I just thought he was doing it. Alistair Campbell was not, and other people are not. There, you know, other people are dealing with their stuff, and he wasn't. He was dealing with a kind, you know, genuinely felt like he was trying to look for ways of making a difference in this very complicated world that we live in.
No, it is. It is definitely. Well, the interesting thing for me is that there's a guy called Yancey Strickler. So the book that I mentioned before, Jamie Bartlett, talks about some of this stuff. And Yancey Strickler, in this particular one, talks about the dark forest theory of the internet, which is a very evocative metaphor. But what he's trying to say is that people are retreating for various reasons to other places. So he says, dark forests like newsletters and podcasts are growing areas of activity, as are other dark forests like Slack channels, private Instagrams, invite-only message boards, text groups, Snapchat, WeChat, and on and on. This is where Facebook is pivoting with groups and trying to redefine what the word privacy means in the process. These are all spaces where depressurized conversation is possible because of their non-indexed, non-optimized, and non-gamified environments. The cultures of those spaces have more in common with the physical world than with the internet. And he calls these dark forests, as if like they're, you know, it's a bad thing or whatever. But actually, this is exactly what we want. Like we want there to be a space where I can be, oh, public, upbeat, happy Doug self promoting my stuff, and also bitching on about people, you know, in a private Slack channel, or having work conversations on Telegram, or sharing pictures with my family on Wire or whatever it is. This is what we want. This is just maturity. This is the way that it goes.
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely, yeah. I think all of that just mimics real life. I'm a different person in front of different people. And I think, I think it's exactly the way it is. We're one thing on this podcast, and we're one thing off this podcast, and we're a whole other thing on Red Dead. And do you know what I mean? Even in our relationship just between each other, you know, sort of thing.
So going back to the Nolan Lawson thing about tech veganism,
uh-huh.
He says, and this links to the dark forest thing, he says, I suspect that tech veganism will begin to shift if it hasn't already. And I think the focus will become less about open source versus closed source, the battle of the last decade, and more about digital well-being, especially in regards to privacy, addiction, and safety. So in this way, it might be less about switching from Windows to Linux, and more about switching from Android to iOS, or from Facebook to more private channels like Discord and WhatsApp. So there is just seems to be this kind of movement of like, be a bit more canny about where you're posting stuff. Because you can't read all the terms and conditions, but you can know that, for example, in this app, nobody can screen, like in Signal, you can't screenshot a secret chat, or like it's knowing those kinds of things. And just to go to a thing which I saved ages ago. This is a newsletter called Ribbon Farm by a guy called Venkatesh Rao. And he has got this term, Walden Ponding. So Walden Pond was Henry David Thoreau and, you know, retreating off to a pond to go and think and make your own house and grow your own crops.
Mm-hmm.
He says in this newsletter, this is against Walden Ponding 2. He says, in the last few years, a seemingly banal question of lifestyle hygiene, how much time, attention, and energy to devote to the screens of our digital devices, has somehow become overloaded with all sorts of angsty philosophical baggage. In those same few years, I've become an increasingly vocal critic of a particular reaction to that angst that I have labeled Walden Ponding, a broad tendency to retreat from and artificially limit digital life. I've gone from thinking of it as annoying but mostly harmless to viewing it as an actively dangerous one. I've gone from muttering about it under my breath to subtweeting and arguing with well-known Walden ponders to writing increasingly polemical essays and Twitter threads about it. To be clear, I don't think Walden ponders are bad people, let alone dark lords. I think they're sincere and well-intentioned. They're just wrong in dangerous ways that make them unwittingly complicit in dark stuff. And he goes through some examples using kind of language about Gandalf and Sauron and stuff. And also he mentions non-playable characters like Undead, which I thought was hilarious. But I'll put the link in the show notes, because he also references Harry Potter and Horcruxes, which I don't understand because I haven't read them or watched the films. But it's an interesting approach to the kinds of people that we talk about both on this podcast and offline, Di, about the type of people who are trying to limit the impact and trying to turn the clock back in some ways to how things used to be and causing all kinds of problems for those of us who are trying to do things in a bit more of a measured and meaningful way.
So, yeah, and I think it's quite interesting, isn't it? So I said an interesting thing to someone the other day, possibly trying to be controversial as I can be, and which was that we have a sort of moral responsibility to share everything, because what's going on at the moment is, so society has evolved in the ways that it's evolved, and there are lots of different cases, things that we've touched on this evening really as well, of how society is only like it is because it's come from where it's come from. And if you actually rebuilt it with the things that we have in place now, you would redesign it entirely differently.
Right.
And which I think is always interesting. You know, I just say the word shoes and I'll stop there. And but there's also a thing which I think, as I mentioned earlier, things are being reshaped at the moment. Things are changing. There's a massive period of transition to do with tech coming, and I don't think it's there yet, but I don't think we're that far off really. I mean, but and part of that, it's a bit sad that GAFAM, or whatever you want to call them, the big tech corps have harnessed this so very well into their own personal profit and or corporate profit, which is making a lot of people rich, I guess. But there's also a point at which the sharing of all of that data, all of those databases that are going live, all that ridiculous data that is getting categorized, people are learning how to use that, and people are not evil. Some of them are. Some of them have poor purposes, shady purposes, or profit purposes, I guess. But lots of people will be trying to do really good things with that data and trying to bring really interesting information to the surface that will actually help us construct and participate in better societies than those that have gone to date. And I don't know. Is the idea of maintaining privacy and blocking and confusing all of that data rather than just embracing it and saying, okay, go see what you can do with my heartbeat, with my genetics, with my whatevers, and learn about the world and then come back up with something that's just so much more intelligent and interesting than the footsteps that have got us here, if you know what I mean. Yeah. Anyway.
No, absolutely. And the link I was looking at while you were talking there was a book which I saw reviewed, and I follow this guy on Twitter as well. It was reviewed in the Guardian at the weekend. Aaron Bastani, who's got a book entitled "Fully Automated Luxury Communism," and he's seen as an accelerationist, as somebody who's on the left of politics, but uh-huh. thinks that actually technology can help us get to a more of a utopian state and away from the fetishization of GDP. More quickly, and that we shouldn't be, you know, doing the traditional things of the left of trying to get everyone to join a union so that we can hold people to account and all this kind of stuff. Instead, we should be advocating for more automation so that people don't have to work as much and that kind of stuff. So this review said that he had some great ideas and some quite naive ones, but I thought I'd throw that in because that's a book that I want to read soon. It's published by Verso, one of my favorite publishers. But I want to go back to the Walden pondering thing, because I think that there's a little bit of this in me. So I'm recognizing this in myself, but I've worked with schools, where people think that they're trying to get the genie back in the bottle. They're trying to say, well, oh, well, if we can only go back to how things used to be, then we wouldn't have this problem. And it's trying to fetishize a particular object or thing of the past. And this is what Venkatesh Rao says in Against Walden Ponding 2. He says, Walden Ponding is a search for meaning that is circumscribed by the way that you, what you might call the spiritual gravity field of an object or behavior, which is held up as ineffably sacred. The associated literal pattern of religiosity is idolatry. Today, the idol in question is generally characterized by negative definition as almost anything other than the profane digital device screen. It can take a variety of forms: the in-person conversation, the board game, the hike in the woods, the session of manual labor, the construction project, the family dinner, the paper book. All are excellent things to be valued for what they literally are. But as suggested, repositories for bits of your soul, they're incredibly dangerous. So that's all very kind of written in a highfalutin way, but basically saying that almost everything is fetishized as being something better than this profane digital device, which is sucking your soul away. And I definitely agree with that.
No, I think that's exactly it. So I was looking, I had an interesting half an hour where I realized that OnePlus have released a new phone, the 7 Pro. And it looks really cool. So I looked at it, and so I've been buying OnePlus devices for the last however many years, because they're sort of, you know, $300-500 for, and it's half the price of the big powerful phones that you get from other companies. And, but this is $800. And I'm thinking, okay, so do I go with that? It looks really good. The reviews are awesome. It's really fantastic. Should I do that? This is my job. I work in technology. I spend a lot of time on my phone. I'm not ashamed of spending time on my phone. Do I need this more powerful device? Should I just get it? Do I need it? Doesn't matter. Am I being the bad person? Am I losing my, you know, all of these sort of different questions are going around in my head. I don't need to spend that money. Why would I spend that money? Surely this is exactly the sort of thing that I don't approve of at times, and I need to sort of sit back and review it a little bit. What I am very sure about is that I'm not scared of Red Dead Online and gaming. I am not scared of overusing social media. I am not scared of making mistakes publicly or privately on the internet. I trust myself to get it right or feel the burn of getting it wrong. But that's not the same for other people who've been in really difficult situations. So it's really hard to say, but I really enjoy using technology. I find it really fabulous. I love the fact that I can go and watch really diverse and interesting things on YouTube, or read about really diverse and interesting things. Like the links that we've looked at tonight, if you just look at the breadth of what it is that we're touching on and seeing, I just love the fact that that comes into my life. And I think if I did not have the technology, it would not be there. Do you know what I mean? I would be stuck at the behest of 3 or 4 media moguls and what content that they felt I was right to be getting. But with the internet, that is not the case. I do get to choose who I go and listen to and what topics I'm thinking about and learning about. I think that's fabulous. And tech is at the bottom of why that happens.
No, it is, absolutely. And we do have a lot more choice than we did. Just to say, on the OnePlus 7, there is the OnePlus 7 and the OnePlus 7 Pro. And the OnePlus 7 is £499.
That's true, yeah. But
I thought, actually, I don't need this. My OnePlus 5 still getting updates. Talking about this reminds me of, some of this is parenting styles. And then you get schools and people within those schools who have different approaches to pedagogy and stuff. And I would say that my wife and I are of the style of parenting of, we would rather our child got injured than never try to do the thing. And I don't know who recommended this book, or if I read it or what, but it's by a Jewish mother, and it's by a clinical psychologist called Wendy Mogul, PhD, and it's called The Blessing of a Skinned Knee, Using Timeless Teachings to Raise Self-Reliant Children. So it's using kind of Jewish family wisdom, I guess, to talk about how to raise children. I haven't started reading it yet, but I bought it secondhand on Amazon, and it's come, and I'm looking forward to reading it.
in a world where entitlement and competition abound, have struck a chord with readers across the globe. Shall I tell you something really interesting, Doug?
What's up?
I'm having a conversation. So one of my colleagues is going to move schools to Gresham's in Norfolk to become head of geography. A good friend of mine. And the head there is a former colleague from here, but not one that I worked with. So he used to be a teacher and a house parent at Oundle, called Dougie Robb. And he's an odd character because he wears a suit, but he wears shorts all of the time. He's a really big bloke, and he was in some kind of car crash, I think, and has problems with his legs. So he likes to wear shorts all of the time, much to the annoyance of my former head master. And anyway, so now he's ahead himself and he's doing that. And my friend went along to for the interview, and he was there with his two dogs lying in front of the fire in his office, this head. But he once put this piece in the TES and in some national newspaper as well. And he was on the radio about it, talking about the snowflake generation and being quite sober about it, really. But because it all turned into a clickbait, he got all of this national press attention. But the subscriptions for his school, the people wanting to come to his school, increased enormously. This is what I found out today, increased enormously as a result of him doing this, because parents just saw that he wasn't going to tolerate the snowflake generation, as it were, and therefore instantly signed their kid up to go to his school.
And
that's the sort of fear that people are living in. And we're talking about parenting quite a lot and the blessing of a skinned knee, which is not unrelated to snowflake generation. And I just thought of that because it said, reflections on parenting in a world where entitlement and competition abound have struck a chord with readers across the globe.
And I the look of shock that other parents give me when, you know, my kids have fallen off stuff and they're lying down the ground crying. I can see that they're, you know, not bleeding to death and they haven't broken their knee. I say, get up.
I think it's interesting, and so I think the idea of a snowflake generation just needs entirely unpacking. So a lot of the kids that I teach are flipping awesome. They're resilient. They don't feel snowflakey to me. They have good minds, but they know stuff that I didn't know when I was young, and well, that stuff.
I think it's going back to that Venkateshwar thing of, like, it's easy to see them looking at devices and think they're wasting their time. Very soft kids when I was young. There were kids whose parents didn't let them outside when it was raining, for goodness sake. I mean, all kinds of stuff.
Absolutely. And I didn't have that kind of upbringing. I was outside quite a lot, but I also was inside being parented by a television quite a lot. And I loved telly still and loved it when I was a kid and watched loads of it. Which is a weird thing in itself when you really start to think about it. But, I don't really know what this snowflake. I remember that the narrative coming through the media at me when I was young, and through society as well, was that the elder generations really did not have a clue, and the evidence that I had at my disposal confirmed that I wasn't. Do you know what I mean? It was so that the adults that I were in my life did not strike me to be as observant and empathic and intelligent as I was. And I don't know.
This is the interesting thing, right? So this is
people are saying people don't have empathy now.
Since we last recorded an episode, people like Tommy Robinson, who lost his deposit in the northwest of England, Nigel Farage, who did very well with the Brexit Party, have all been milkshaked. Yeah. And I think the phrase was lactose against intolerance, which I thought was a
we love a play on words.
It's been thrown. Apparently, as we speak, Donald Trump is in London for the state visit, and apparently the Metropolitan Police have been told to keep everyone at least milkshake throwing distance away, which prompted a conversation that I was involved in on Macedon about milkshake trebuchets, drone-based deployment of milkshakes, etc. Which was obviously hilarious. But where was I going with that?
totally I don't know. That is hilarious. A milkshake trebuchet.
Yeah. So you've got people like Nigel Farage, who's using the imagery of Dunkirk and World War II and all this kind of stuff. And given the age he is, he is the child of someone who would have been an age of to fight in World War II. So he is like a post-World War II baby, which have to be the softest generation, I would say. Like, they have been so pampered and well looked after, and I'm including, you know, my parents in this, and people.
Mine too. Well, I don't know. My parents are pretty tough. You know, they're tough kind of cookies. They know how to deal with stuff. They know how to roll their sleeves up. They're not lazy. But they have lived under that, on that baby boomer wave or whatever, you know, and they are in a really good situation. My dad gets paid more now on his pension than he ever did in his wage.
Really?
Oh yeah. God. He's been retired 25 years. And had great deals when, you know, when they were retired, he was retiring. He got great deals. So,
This is the thing. We get all of the, and I think every generation does this, like looks at the younger generation, goes, oh my goodness me, look at that. But you've got older people talking about avocado toast and how people need to save their money while they're on literally the best pensions that have ever been created in the history of the universe.
Yeah, yeah. But my mum and dad, you know, my mum and dad ate baked beans so that we could have good vegetables. You know what I mean? That's, they had no money. They were screwed when they were younger. They didn't go to university or anything like that. And so my dad had to work his way up from T-boy at the bank. And that sort of thing. Is he a self-made man? Well, maybe, I don't know. But he's also been under these fantastic circumstances, economic circumstances, I guess, and that have just worked really, really well for him. Okay. All those.
Well, maybe context is everything. It's 10 o'clock here. So I want to finish on something which I thought was fantastic. This is Kotka, kotka.org. If you're listening to this and you don't subscribe to kotka.org, which has to be one of the oldest blogs on the internet, it is just wonderful. Every day there's fantastic stuff. And I support kotka.org. I'm a member of it. And Jason Kotka pulls this thing out from an archive.org post. You know, so it's no longer on the internet. It's now been archived. 2005 by Michael Barish. And what is said in this really helps you frame, like for me, helps you frame the peaks and the troughs of your life. So, yeah. Shall we take in turns to read each paragraph?
Sure. In 1988, Laura and I created a three-stage model of what we called living process. We called the three stages good thing, rut, and transition. As we saw it, good thing becomes rut, rut becomes transition, and transition becomes good thing. It's a continuous circuit.
A good thing never leads directly to a transition, in large part because it has no reason to. A good thing wants to remain a good thing, and this is precisely why it becomes a rut. Ruts, on the other hand, want desperately to change into something else.
Transitions can be indistinguishable from ruts. The only important difference is that new events can occur during transitions, whereas ruts, by definition, consist of the same thing happening over and over.
And it's such a simple thing, but I thought it was such a lovely way of framing the fact that you can't go from good thing to good thing. There has to be some kind of, if it's a roller coaster, if it's some kind of graph, there has to be a low point before you can get back to a good thing. And certainly helping me understand where I am kind of in my life at the moment.
Joy and pain, it's like sunshine and rain. It's all about contrast, eh?
It is.
You don't have good without bad. You don't have good without evil or whatever it is. I don't know. Mm.
Well, this is my theory of, you know, the if you try... I don't understand people who sleep in, and sorry, Di, if you do this, if you sleep in like silk sheets and you have like amazing luxury at home, I don't get it. Like, how do you then have a contrast when you go on holiday or do anything out of the ordinary? How is that then better? It's not.
That's a really good point, and yet still doesn't hold up somehow.
What do you mean?
I don't know. It's just like, I kind of think, so what I think is the idea of holidays is wrong. That's what I think. I think it's one of those things that we do. And I think, you know, those things that I was talking about, how life and society has evolved, and that the idea of going on a holiday every year, it's really fantastic. And some of my favorite times as a child and an adult have been on holiday with people I love and care for. And So it's hard to poo-poo, and I don't do it lightly. But I've always thought, it's always seemed a little bit bonkers to me that the holiday, that was the case, actually, that the holiday was the thing that held the goodness. And why didn't the goodness be in our day-to-day life, you know, in a kind of different way?
That's a focal point to remember stuff. So today, I walked from where I live now in Morpeth past a place called Ellington, where we used to live. And that's
I know
where
Ellington.
He lived from when he was two until he was, you know, seven. But what do I remember? I can't remember all of the everyday stuff. The things that popped into my mind were when there was a fire, which we've talked about in this podcast before, at the bird hide and his reaction to that. I remembered when he had a flower pot on his head and was kicking a football. I remember dancing around the sofa to very loud music. I can't remember all of the interactions. So you have to have some kind of compression, some kind of like, anyway, we're getting massively off topic here, but I think there's something to be said in understanding that, as you say, everything is about contrast, and that not everything can be a good thing all of the time.
And no, it can't. I completely concur.
Okay, Di, what are you up to for the next week or so, or before we get to...
What am I doing? I've got stuff going on. I can't remember all of it right now because it's been a long day. On Thursday, I'm going to a lecture at Oxford University, which I'm looking forward to, on something to do with formative assessment and remote learning, and how it can consolidate and so essentially, I can't remember the exact name of the lecture that's going to be given, but it's what I felt like when I looked at it, is it's sort of looking at remote learning and online learning and how we can make that better. And there's some research that started to look at that. So I'm going to go and listen and see what I think.
Is that something you're doing on your own time, or?
Yeah, nothing to do with school. It's just because I'm really, because I think that technology obviously has a massive future in education, and I'm not quite sure how, and I want to explore what that's going to look like, you know.
Very good. Well, I'm doing Moodle stuff until Friday this week. So it's Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. I'm doing that, and then it'll be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday next week, and then I'm going to have a 4-day weekend. And I'm thinking about going walking somewhere in the Lake District or somewhere.
Cool. I'm going to be in the Lake District for the last week of June.
You're going to be there?
Yeah, you're in Gold Divi.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
Oh, the last weekend I've got scout camp.
So all right. All right. Well, cool. Brilliant. Well, it's been lovely to talk to you. If you listened this far, well done to you. It's been lovely to talk to you as well, I guess.
I'm never sure whether to put links of things we didn't get to into the show notes. I didn't last time because there were like millions. But we've got, probably about 10, maybe more things that we didn't get to today. What do you think?
I don't care.
Good response. I think that if it's not in the podcast,
I'm trying to think. No, I don't. So why would people go on the show notes? So if they're, because especially people are coming through podcasting apps, like Spotify or SoundCloud or whatever, rather than through the website. So you have to go and look out the show notes. So if something takes somebody's interest, then that's what it's there for. I think are references for the things that we talk about. And if they think, oh, that sounds interesting, I want to go and see that Calvin and Hobbes advert, they'd probably just search for it. And if they remember the name of the book, that's what I would do, to be honest.
Yeah, so let's not put the things we don't get to. That's fair enough. Cool. Okay. Well, thank you for listening, everyone. And we will record another one of these at some point in the future.
Very committal. Sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, sitting on the dock of a bay.